You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now in the 1990s, curators jumped from the wings to spotlit centre stage. All at once, the phenomenon of so-called star curators emerged as both the cause of and solution to art world problems. But while that wave's impact can be measured in inflated air miles and sprawling high-concept exhibitions few people could afford to travel to, an earlier wave of curators and directors were arguably more dynamic, innovative, and impactful in terms of supporting practice and facilitating institutional change. My guest this week is one of that latter generation of pioneers. Since the 1970s, Sandy Nairn has traversed and played a key part in significant shifts in the UK's art world. Starting as an assistant to Richard DeMarco in 1972, Nairn's next role as assistant director of MoMA Oxford from 1972 to 74, propelled him through directorships at the ICA, the Arts Council of Great Britain, Tate, and most recently, the National Portrait Gallery. In 1984, he wrote the groundbreaking television series State of the Art, an innovative set of programmes that took the pulse of an art world grappling with postmodernism and a burgeoning internationalism. The breadth and depth of that series, in addition to Nairn's exhibition history and support for marginalised artists and discourses, stand as a testament to his status as one of the most important curator-directors in Britain of the past 30 years. I met Sandy at his home in North London and was keen to find out if, in 1972, he had any idea his career in contemporary art would be as long and illustrious.
Certainly not. I had no idea. I suppose by 72, I definitely had some ideas about art. But I was entirely, at that stage, thinking about contemporary art and thinking about artists. So yeah, so it was a very particular way of starting, I guess.
And how did you accumulate your art historical knowledge? Because at Oxford, you studied history and economics, right?
That's right. Yeah, I think nowadays I would be really frowned on because I didn't take an art history degree and I didn't do a curating course because I think these things are really good, but I didn't do them. I think in that period one was able, a bit more than one can now, to just take what one could get, take opportunities. And I think it was really finding other artists. I mean, when I started organising anything, and it was when I was at Oxford, at college, it was just showing a few of my own drawings, showing some other artists, student artists that I knew. And that drew me in right at the beginning. But pretty soon on, the fact is that the person I really bumped into in that very, very early period was Richard DeMarco, a great gallerist from Edinburgh. And it was meeting Ricky, who was, of course, doing these amazing things of having invited Joseph Beuys and all the Dusseldorf artists to Edinburgh and then bringing sort of waves of terrific artists from Poland and many other countries. Anyway, so that was the breakthrough for me.
When I started to look back at Richard DeMarco, I initially thought it might have been just a quiet gallery showing sort of paintings, like Sunday painters, but that was not the case at all. I mean, was this really your sort of grounding in the contemporary scene?
More than a grounding, it was an absolutely astonishing for me. It wasn't that I didn't have some idea, but I didn't really have an idea. And certainly artists of the kind of power and impact of Joseph Beuys, and they were there. So it wasn't just a question of sort of here was some of their work and getting to understand what that was, you know, intellectually challenging to grapple with. But there he was, and this is the period in which he was doing his great lectures with blackboards and these great, you know, 4-hour, 5-hour pieces. And then the other person who was very important, particularly for me, was Tadeusz Kantor and the Krico Theatre coming over from Poland. I mean, he was just someone completely astonishing. So all this, for me, was really a new world.
And what did that new world sort of mean to you at that time? Did you have... What were your expectations of like how you could be involved in that world? Did you have any conceptions?
I don't think I did. No, I think I just thought if I could help a bit, that's fine. I just thought if I can do a bit, if I can get involved. But the thing about Ricky was that Ricky had an absolutely kind of brilliant habit of throwing people in at the deep end. I mean, his way was that if you turned up as a student, I was a student, student helper, if you turned up, he just threw you into whatever needed doing. Mm. So suddenly I was, you know, negotiating licenses for a big environmental fire project that was meant to take place on each of the hills of Edinburgh, and I had to go and try and organise with the city authorities. I mean, things I'd had no idea about doing. But he just said, get on with it.
At the moment, because curating has gone through a phase of professionalisation distinct from what it would have been in the early part of the 20th century, because the curatorial position has been around for a long time. But today there is that sort of emphasis on being a jack of all trades, being a diplomat, being someone who has a grasp of economics, but also the administrative side, and then somebody who kind of knows a broad swathe of cultural production. And now that seems to be like a given, like you have to accumulate that. But at that, for you, I mean, it seemed like you were having to do it, but there was no rule book. There was no one saying that's what you had to do. But
I think, you see, that I think the thing that wasn't there then, or certainly wasn't for me, was the word curator. I don't think I would have even, you know, I wouldn't have used that word.
So how did you think of yourself then?
Well, I think I was just thought I was helping. I mean, I think I was just, you know, I was being an organiser. So that when, you know, I bump into the young Anthony McCall, who'd been doing some things in Edinburgh, and he's doing these fire projects, and then so I said, well, why don't you come and do one in Oxford? And then I can get a hold of, well, I can persuade somebody to lend a playing field. And so, you know, I'm doing organising one of the early fire projects for Anthony McCall. But I don't think I thought of myself as curating it. I think I just thought, oh, let's organise it, let's do it, let's make something happen.
Do you think there was a kind of innate tendency there for you to get involved in that way? Because if the role wasn't there and you were just thinking of yourself as an organiser, how did you know you had a kind of compulsion to do that? Was it purely by accident that you discovered it?
It was just exciting. I mean, I think it was just the excitement of these artists. And I think these were, you know, this is Fluxus time. Mm. This is when you've got artists who themselves are completely dissolving, deliberately dissolving, plenty of kind of boundaries between artists, writers, critical thinkers. And the ideas were as exciting as anything. And frankly, I suppose they were more exciting than some of the economics and the history that I was meant to be studying. So I think it just felt like it was really exciting to help artists. And it was also really exciting to begin to think, well, who else could, you know, I could... How could one make bridges to people who might not have enjoyed this stuff or found this stuff? And, you know, things like, you know, it's very crude, but us as students organising a May Day festival, inviting Genesis Peoridge to come and do May Day events. I mean, all kinds of kind of crazy things. But there was a spirit of sharing. I mean, you know, come on, this is just post-60s. I mean, there is a bit of a kind of post-hippie-ish period in which you're making things happen. And that sense of happenings was still very much around.
Do you think you always had that sense of inclusivity then? Because in what you were saying then, there was an awareness of an outside. And sometimes art history and maybe curatorial practice can be quite hermetic. But for me, throughout your career, there always seems to be an awareness of different levels of activity.
Yeah, I think, but I don't know that it was very conscious. Right. I think it was more just taking this as an opportunity. Here's an artist. Why don't we make something interesting happen? And I think one doesn't really stop and analyse very much what was there. You know, I spent my second year at college running a student art centre. Because it was there, and because it seemed like an interesting thing to do. And I was lucky enough to go to a university, which frankly we were given unbelievable freedom to get on and organise our own things. And, you know, as long as you sometimes turned in some essays, well, actually quite regularly turned in essays, you would kind of could get through. So I frankly exploited that rotten in terms of being able to do other things.
So your first job after graduating from Oxford in 1974 was as assistant director to Nicholas Sirota at the Museum of Modern Art in Oxford. How prepared were you for that role?
I got to know the people, the little now Modern Art Oxford, the little Museum of Modern Art in Pembrokeshire, and of course not a museum, as is well known. Had already, you know, with other students, we used to go and help out. There was a sort of bunch of us who would go and, you know, invigilate or just organise talks and do things there. And there was this moment towards the end of 73 when they appointed a new director. And we heard about this guy who worked at the Arts Council. He sounded a bit kind of official. We thought he was sounded a bit kind of formal. And then this tall, rather then long-haired fellow called Nicholas Sirota turned up. And he was quite an impact, because I mean, he was just obviously both charming and knowledgeable and interesting, and he had lots of new energy. So by the time it got to the sort of spring of 74, and he was already, you know, he was working with, well, as it happened, Joseph Beuys,
yeah,
did that great, great drawing show and many other things he was talking about. So when I had the opportunity, when I finished my final exams, to go and work with him, I mean, you know, I leapt at it. Actually, that's not quite true. Very briefly, I stopped and paused and thought, hang on, shouldn't I have a proper profession? And I very, very briefly tested the idea whether I should become a town planner. But I tested it for about 2 days, went to see the president of the Royal Institute of Town Planners, and quickly realised I had actually no interest in becoming a town planner, and took the job with Nick. I was very lucky. I mean, I was very lucky to kind of, in effect, get an apprenticeship.
And so, like, you've never looked back and thought twice about your possible alternative history as a town planner?
I did say at that time, maybe we all do this, I don't know. I did say to myself, okay, why don't I see what I can do in the next 5 years? Mm. And at the end of 5 years, if I'm still uncertain, you know, then I could go and do a proper professional qualification. Anyway, by the end of 5 years, I was working at the ICA and doing other things. So by then I realised, yeah, I was on some other kind of course.
So you arrived like 1 year after the first oil crisis in 1973. What was the atmosphere like at the time?
Well, that last year of studying, we had some of our seminars by candlelight. Because it was the 3-day week, and people sometimes don't remember, or you know, weren't around at the time, that this was extraordinary. I mean, here you had the moment of real crunch between, if you like, between labour and capital, but more particularly if negotiated relations between unions and government, that wasn't working. Mm. I mean, it just wasn't working. And I remember vividly thinking, well, okay, we're discussing economics in this seminar by candlelight, but frankly, this is politics. I mean, okay, economics might inform it, but I was very aware that one was thinking about, well, where are the politics in this and what can we understand? I think it was a very difficult period, but there was no, if you like, I still think, you know, often difficult periods are pretty good for artists because, you know, you're looking at artists as, it's an overused phrase, but they're sort of free thinkers, to be looking at other issues that are going to matter and other ideas that might really be important that are not just the kind of confrontations, however evident those were, of this sort of big stage.
And I mean, that was quite a dynamic decade. So, I mean, I guess you have the first oil crisis in 1973 and then the second one in 1979 bookends it. What were some of the currents and sort of energies that were galvanising the art world at the time? Was it a kind of a political urgency happening there? Or did things become slightly harder edged?
I think of it as a period of great contest because the establishment felt like still a very considerable establishment with a kind of fairly capital E, so that the, you know, the institutions, whether it was the Royal Academy or indeed to some degree even the Tate, which is where I went after I'd had the period working at Oxford, although Tate, to be fair to many of the people at Tate had been trying to make already quite a lot of change, but it was still quite sort of nascent about, well, what would really a new kind of museum be like? That wasn't yet clear. And then even within the Tate, when I got there in 76, we had tremendous battles of really differing opinions about what mattered in art. And of course, the thing that was in the centre of that was the bricks. The famous Carl Andre 120 fire bricks, equivalent 8, that the Tate had bought. And then you'll remember the story that the Tate bought it and then didn't particularly tell anybody, and then rather later put it in a biennial review.
Yeah, because was it purchased in like 73 or
that's
something
right.
like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, it was purchased in the early 70s, but it wasn't until 76 that it suddenly, somebody, it was because there was a biennial review had published the acquisition. And then it went crazy into what a load of bricks. And of course, you know, now I look back and it was a kind of moment in popular culture that was really interesting. You know, front page of the Sun? Anyway, very prominent, and the cartoons and everything. But in the Tate, to be there as a junior was very uncomfortable because actually the very bit of the Tate, including the then director Norman Reed, who had very much allowed a period in the early 70s to allow minimal and some conceptual work, to be quiet, suddenly this all shut down. There was a real sense of pulling back, of retrenchment, of no more of that.
Oh, really? So that the furore happening in the sort of tabloid press had an immediate effect on...
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. I mean, there was a bunch of us working at the Tate who put together, who thought, of course, this was fascinating to be able to do, to think about this as a sort of animation about ideas of engagement and popular public. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity to have the kind of nation thinking about a really important major work of minimal art by Carl André. And we put together a thing called the Bricks Book, where we thought, well, why don't we put together the cartoons, the critical pieces, and then we got somebody to write a sort of educational piece, and then a sort of more serious curatorial piece. We got the whole thing into proof, and then the director said, no, we're not going to publish it.
And why? What was his reticence? Why?
It was a really bad moment. I mean, it was a really difficult moment. And I think he just thought it would stir everything up again, whereas we thought quite the opposite. We thought... It's not so much that it'll stir, it'll make it more, much more interesting and extending that. But then that was followed pretty soon. You may be aware there was a moment when David Hockney wrote a piece in The Observer about the fact that Tate hadn't been buying any new, if you like, historical figurative work. And he particularly caught a moment when the great figure of Edward Hopper, and he picked on this fact that the Tate didn't have. Actually, it still doesn't. Is this right? I think it still doesn't have an Edward Hopper painting. Anyway, he identified something that was absolutely true, really, that the Tate's view of modernism, and this was really what it was all about, was, you know, which kind of modernism are we talking about? And so on one side, you've got all this popular stuff against the bricks, and then on the other side, you had quite a bunch of people within the art world, a prominent figure like Hockney, attacking the Tate and saying, well, you know, Rothko's all very well, all this sort of tradition of abstraction, well, it's fine, but it's missing out a huge swathes of other kinds of modernism. And of course, we as junior staff were completely with Hockney. We thought he was absolutely right. So this was another... Yeah. So anyway, if you like to answer your question, certainly in art world terms, all this felt very contested. The small number of the new galleries, you know, the commercial galleries, so Nigel Greenwood and Listen... was a small world. I mean, it was a very intensely interesting world, but it wasn't very many. I mean, that's one of the things that feels such a great contrast to now, that you know, this was, these were people trying to make new things happen.
So you leave Tate in 1979 and make your way over to the ICA as director, maybe not as neat as that.
It's not quite as neat. It's only that this sense of sort of difficulty at Tate did mean that I realised that I couldn't really stay at the Tate. I mean, it was the sort of, I remember, you know, you'd go round or someone would say, oh, you work at the Tate, that must be a great place to work. And it was hard to say, no, actually, it doesn't feel like a great place. It really got very difficult. And as I say,
why was that? Was it just because there was no room to move? And like your opinion wasn't being listened to?
It was partly because I think structurally it was caught between different periods and generations. And it was also things, you know, weren't very well organised. I mean, it wasn't for the Tate was, you know, there was a figure like Michael Compton, who was, you know, Michael was a great head of exhibitions and beginning to organise some really important exhibitions. And of course, you have to remember that up until the building of the Hayward, the Tate didn't organise their own exhibitions. The Arts Council did. The Arts Council did its exhibitions at the Tate. And then it's only when the Arts Council gets the Hayward, and that's another story about whether the Arts Council should ever have been organising their own exhibitions, but they did. Only then does the Tate really take on its own exhibition programme led by Michael Compton. So it wasn't that there were, and the education department led by Terry Meacham, Simon Wilson were doing really interesting things. It wasn't that there weren't interesting things, there were. But overall, there was this sense that for certainly any of us, I think a bit younger, you couldn't see how this was going to work out. So anyway, the ICA presented itself with Bill McAllister as director, and I applied and I was lucky enough to be appointed to go as director of exhibitions. I'd actually spent 6 months being registrar at the Tate because things needed kind of sorting. I actually spent 6 months sort of, if you like, below stairs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Like, what? Because so it's like a series of administrative jobs on the surface, and I wondered, what had you learnt there? What were you accumulating during that time?
Well, the thing I really remember is that the very pretty much the last moment, at the end of 79, I leave a memo saying, look, I think it would be quite a good idea if we put all the collection. We've got the beginnings of these card indexes, and there are these notions about computerization that people are beginning to talk about. And of course, it's hard to imagine, but it's pre-contemporary digital thinking in every way, mm-hmm. and it's very hard to remember that, you know, there were perfectly good ways of organizing things, but the sense of how do you get things done. But the more difficult thing was that a lot of it was very upstairs, downstairs, that literally the curators all worked at the top of the building and they had windows and all the technical staff worked in the basement. It was very divided.
It seems like in British society on a whole that there was this, people were recognising that there was a kind of an older established way of doing things which had an eye to tradition, but that now was anachronistic in relationship to like the modern world.
Things needed to change. Yeah. And actually, I was asked to be registrar because I think somebody noticed, or I don't know why, they'd somehow said, oh, Sandy, you know, you seem to have been taking an interest in things happening in America and other museums about how to organise things. And I don't think it was anything very special, but I remember pretty much the first thing I did was to say, look, if you look at it, the technicians start at 8:30 in the morning, they have a tea break at 10:30, the curators start at 10 and then they have a coffee break at 11, and they all have lunch times that are different and they have tea at a different time. No wonder they don't know where they are. They can't find each other. You've got to do some pretty, actually they're not very difficult things to try and get this to work better.
Where do you think you got that knack for organising from?
Probably from my dad. I mean, I grew up, actually my mum as well, to be fair, because she was a brilliant organiser as well as my dad. But yeah, I grew up with a civil servant father who was a very, very determined manager, organiser, director and leader of how to do things better. And how to do things better for public service. I mean, that was certainly the spirit that, you know, we as a bunch of kids were brought up with.
But then art was also important, though, wasn't it? I mean, you must have had a sense of art in the home. Like, it wasn't all just get up 8 o'clock, brush your teeth, come down for breakfast.
There was all of that. I was very lucky to have a very, very supportive, terrific home upbringing with my dad in the Scottish tradition of amateur watercolour painting. So painting and art and interest in art was always around. But it was always the sort of measured thing. I mean, for my dad, art was really important, but it wasn't what he did. I mean, what his work was helping run government. Yeah. But he didn't take it less seriously. And the same with reading, that reading and ideas were absolutely part of it. And, you know, I was very privileged. I was given a privileged schooling of independent schooling. So I was, you know, incredibly lucky to get all this stuff as a kind of input as I was growing up.
Yeah, but you definitely made use of it, though.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. So, you know, so around this time as well, like just after, or maybe before, maybe you can let me know, you helped organise the British Sculpture Show with Nick Sirota, right? Now, was this in a way feels like it might have been a chance for you to put into practice a lot of the things that you were thinking about, like how there's a disconnect between maybe institutional practice and what's sort of happening on the ground. Can you talk a bit about this concept of New British Sculpture? And also, because I came across the Arts Council of England documentary with you in it. I was going to bring it on a laptop and show it to you, but I thought I'd spare you.
Thank
Not
you.
That you were brilliant in it, but... So this sense of a new British sculpture, what were you trying to achieve with the show?
There was a moment at the Tate when the Tate was finishing off what was prosaically referred to as the 1979 extension. It's the back right-hand corner where all the temporary exhibitions upstairs happen. But it got delayed, and it was really good. It was one of those things where a delay is good for young curators, because there was a delay, and we all our planning for resetting the collection sort of went awry. And I was allowed to do three displays, and I thought, gosh, British sculpture, really interesting in the modern period. What I did, I just did something called carved, modelled, constructed, and used those techniques. And it was Nick, Sirota. Nick came back and said, I saw your displays. I thought that was really interesting. It made me think one could do a much bigger exhibition of British sculpture. And so pretty quickly in discussion, we realised that to do it, it would need the whole Whitechapel twice. And I, between us, we thought, this is pretty bold, but why don't we do it? So, yeah, it was great. So we co-curated. He was director of Whitechapel. I was still at the Tate. And of course, actually, one of the advantages, I shouldn't be so harsh about the Tate, one of the advantages was that you could actually do other projects. Mm. Because it wasn't so focused as it is now, in terms of getting everything done, actually, there was quite a lot of leeway. So I could, I mean, I had to ask, but I could go and work with Nick. And I finished that off by the time I got to the ICA. And it was, I mean, of course, working with Nick, I'd started in Oxford, but curatorial and research-wise, yeah, it was really good to do a historical project. And then, of course, I remember after we'd opened the first and got a pretty good response of thinking about partly British sculpture in a more in a broader way. There were figures like Eric Kennington or Alfred Drury or figures from Edwardian or interwar period that somehow got lost, who we were very keen to kind of get back. And I remember right at the end of it that we got to a point and Alan Bowness, who'd just become director of Tate, Alan said, oh, I think this should have happened at the Tate. And Nick and I were nearly screaming because I think that is what we felt. Mm. It was, well, the Tate doesn't do these things. And so, okay. But I think the spirit that Nick had and I had the same was, we're not going to wait to see what others are doing. We're going to get on with it. Mm-hmm. So that was certainly the spirit of that sculpture show. And then, of course, the other bit of the story was that it so happened that we were both very aware that this was this new generation mm-hmm. of Anthony Gormley and Alison Wilding and these kind of young, terrifically Anish Kapoor and others were just coming up. So it was a very interesting moment.
And looking back on this sort of new British sculpture phenomenon, because in a way, when I think about new British sculpture, I almost, because Gormley and Kapoor have kind of outlived it, whereas someone like David Mack hasn't really moved into the contemporary in the same way, it's almost like they seem to personify it more than Kapoor and Gormley. What's your thinking about that whole, the new British sculpture idea now? I mean, how?
Well, it's one of those classics where when we first, certainly Nick and I were first looking at it, and then very quickly I was then at the ICA, and of course it was with Ivona Blaswick, who was my assistant director at the ICA on exhibitions, and it was Ivona and I then looking at it, and then with Lewis Biggs, the three of us put together this show called Objects and Sculpture. Mm. And at that point, what was striking to us was that some of the artists in Objects and Sculpture, they didn't know each other. I mean, we did that as a two-part show. We did it in London and Bristol. So I think Jean-Luc Villemuth and Anthony Gormley, I mean, they were making pieces that were very, very similar because they were in the spirit of the time. There was a more urban feeling. This was, if you like, a kind of counterpoint to Richard Long and Hamish Fulton, who'd been done interesting things.
The Walkers, yeah.
Yeah, who'd done some lovely things in the period coming out of the 60s into the 70s. But this was something humorous, grittier, more urban. I mean, Bill Woodrow was cutting up those washing machines and... But what was intriguing to us was that they didn't really know each other. So we were just forming what one tries to do, I suppose, in a good bit of curatorial work of saying, well, let's look at something together. And then, of course, what happened was that Listen Gallery piled in and formed something called, oh, let's call it New British Sculpture. Yeah. Michael Newman wrote a piece in Art in America, which actually was the kind of trigger for it to be kind of called something. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't call it New British Sculpture. But that's what happens. That's the way things work between public and private sector.
And what about that Arts Council programme? Because I didn't realise Arts Council made films.
Well, they had a strand. Rodney Wilson used to lead a bit for the Arts Council of them having a sort of strand of artist films as well as documentary films. I mean, they were supporting artists and they were supporting documentary films.
Were they broadcast on television or were they just for who was getting to see them?
Nothing got TV really at that period. Right. So they were being circulated and they would be circulated. Well, so, you know, back in Oxford days, we used to borrow. I had to learn how to spool up thread a projector because we would show film shows of 16mm films, of artist films. And, you know, it's another age technically, but it was good. So the Arts Council used to offer these things on circuit and they go to art colleges, right. And they probably go to some high schools, certainly to art galleries who were interested. And I think the programme you're thinking of is the one that was done with the Hayward Show.
That's right.
And it was made by John Wyver and Jeff Dunlop.
Yeah, and it had David Max laying the tyres down.
Right. Yeah, for the sort of the submarine piece.
Yeah.
So that was, well, that was interesting because I thought they were trying to get into, could you do something in film terms? Mm. And I don't think they got a TV slot for that. But it certainly was interesting to me because actually it meant I thought these were people who knew how to make film in a really sympathetic way. Mm. And for me, that's what led to State of the Art.
So that was that your first taste of broadcasting then, that programme?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I might have done the odd interview, but it was the first time I got more involved. And then I realised that here was a couple of filmmakers in John Wyver and Jeff Dunlop who I thought were really sympathetic. And I really thought, hang on, one could do something.
So let's talk about State of the Art then, because now we've got, I've got the DVD here, and I'm just going to go to my notes because I want to make sure I give this the proper introduction that it deserves. So, so you were writer and producer of State of the Art, which was a series of six 50-minute programmes looking at contemporary art in the 1980s, but also before that and speculating about what was to come. And the programmes were arranged according to six themes: history, value, imagination, sexuality, politics, and identity. For me, this is one of the most groundbreaking television programmes I've ever seen. And having done a bit of arts broadcasting, the amnesia about its existence is striking. It is really striking. Tell me a bit about how this project came together. Did it come out of the knowledge that you'd accumulated at DeMarco, at Tate, at MoMA, and also then at the ICA, which I imagine pulls together all of that stuff, but in a kind of urban, metropolitan setting?
Yeah, ICA, for me, in the early 80s, was a terrific period, and certainly the kinds of exhibitions that I and Devonna Blaswick were putting on. We did quite a lot of shows of American artists, Robert Mapplethorpe or Jenny Holzer or Barbara Kruger. So, I mean, really interesting kind of new generation of people coming through. Never mind some really interesting artists working here and in Europe. Anyway, I think what happened for me was that at the ICA, everything was sort of getting to be, we were a bit crazy. We did I don't know how many exhibitions. We were doing about 12 exhibitions a year. I mean, some of them were large ones. I mean, some of them were smaller, but I think we were very impatient. I think we kind of couldn't wait to do the next exhibition.
That's a lot. 12 a year.
No, it was crazy. We were really crazy. I think we couldn't understand why anybody would want to waste and hang around for 3 months for an exhibition. It would seem like way too long, and we just didn't put them on very long. And, you know, we'd be working through the night. It was all kind of, you know, it was well ordered, but it was crazy too. Anyway, I think what happened to me was I suddenly realised that there were things one couldn't do in exhibitions. You could do so much in an exhibition, but only so much. So I began to think about, well, could you do something else for television? If there was a television opportunity, could you make something else happen to reach a wider audience about contemporary art? And of course, the moment was Channel 4. And so it was the founding of Channel 4 that made me think, well, hang on, is this an opportunity? So that's where the idea of State of the Art came from, was to say, let's put a proposition into Channel 4. And Michael Cousteau, who was the commissioning editor in that early period, you know, it's hugely to Michael's credit that he gave us the opportunity to make 6 one-hour programmes for what ended up as a pretty prime-time slot on a Sunday night, and to make a series about looking at contemporary art around the world.
And so tell me how it started then. So it was yourself and Jeff and John
Wyver.
And what was it? It was just meeting in cafes, discussing?
Yeah, a bit of that. But I mean, they'd put to me, and I'd put down first what I thought was the proposition. And the proposition came partly out of thinking, what else has happened in the space of broadcast television and thinking about art. Mm-hmm. And the figure, if you like, the counterpoint that was most in my mind was Robert Hughes and Shock of the New, which had been Robert Hughes's. I mean, people kind of link it back to Kenneth Clark and Civilization a bit, but in some ways, I don't think that's quite, because, you know, the span of that was huge historically, whereas Robert Hughes was making a kind of argumentative essay in, you know, his own very particular style of saying, you know, I'm going to show you, I'm going to tell you what it is that I think is great. But the counterpoint that was really important was John Berger, was Ways of Seeing. So, you know, it's nice of you to mention a breakthrough, but the real breakthrough is John Berger. I mean, it's the BBC kind of incredible that it ever happened, that the BBC allowed John Berger. And, you know, I go back and watch Ways of Seeing, and I think that's fantastic. I mean, he just, you know, he challenges so much of how we think about things. He doesn't get much to race, but he does get to think about feminist questions. But from our perspective, thinking about state of the art, the most obvious thing was it was still another guy in front of camera telling you stuff. Mm. So actually one of the you know, there were two main propositions for state of the art. One was that I was never going to appear, there was going to be no presenter, and that I wouldn't be there. And you also wouldn't hear me, there'd be nothing of my voice. In other words, if I had a voice, it was in the writing and in the ideas and in choosing the artists and bringing all that together. And then the idea of thematic seemed to me to be really important as a different way of trying to talk about how we look at art. And I think particularly for me, the final programme on identity, where we start in Australia and we're using the occasion of the Sydney Biennale to look at what was happening between these fantastic artists, Aboriginal artists, and we work with particularly great painter Michael Nelson Chakamara, who had been at that point part of the Sydney Biennial. And then, you know, come here and look at the terrific younger generation just emerging of Keith Piper and Donald Rodney and Sonia Boyce. And then we're in New York and we're with Andy Warhol and Jean-Michel Basquiat. In other words, we were picking places and artists with whom, from whom and with whom we could try and talk about some of these issues. This is how we were trying to think about it.
I mean, there's so much to sort of come back on what you're just saying. The first thing I'd like to talk about though is just or acknowledge is the stylistic innovations that were offered in that programme that haven't been taken up and I think should be, because they allow for so much more. One of them is absenting the presenter, which I don't see. That's just been taken up so wholesale, we need someone to guide you through in order for you to understand the idea, which leads to formula, which leads to convention, which leads to tired programming.
But it annoyed people. I mean, we got terrible reviews.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the television critics. I mean, some other people were quite nice about it. The television critics panned it. Mm. They said, oh, we can't tell what's going on. We don't know where we are. you know, it's all too chaotic. It's all too kind of postmodern. Mm. You know, the sound, you can't always hear what's happening on the sound. You've got these overlays and this complexity. So the TV critics really didn't like it. Some of the conventional art critics, Peter Fuller sort of school, also absolutely hated it. But in a sense, we felt not so much that we didn't care about what the critics felt, it was more that we felt we were doing other things and we were speaking to a much wider audience through Channel 4. We did an exhibition alongside it, we published a book. The book was always going to be an important thing, and the books continued, I think, to have a place. So I think we, and of course we had debates. I mean, every week, actually, to their credit with Tate, every week we would show the programme at Tate and then we'd have some of the artists there at Tate. And we did kind of weekly live debate as the series was going out.
See, that is something that, that also could have a place today and doesn't.
Yeah, I think TV,
yeah, I know,
TV. Is TV. And TV, you know, Channel 4 wouldn't give anybody that amount of space, I'm sorry to say now. I mean, I wish they would. I mean, I wish they'd be giving you and others those opportunities. They absolutely should be. But I think I don't think I would say, you know, there's no great principle about removing the presenter. For that moment, at that time in the 80s, it felt important to kind of remove the presenter.
So let's talk about that last programme, because I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one of the ones that, I mean, they're all striking for different reasons for me. One of them is just spotting how young people look, but also how earnest, actually, and spiky. And that also the device of people speaking directly to the lens. That is really important.
This was very important to us, and you've absolutely got it, that we thought, hang on, we want to do this with the artist, and we must prioritise the artist's voice. And we were so aware that you can't say to somebody, talk to camera, because it's a trained thing. I mean, it's part of training, as you know. So our brilliant camera person, Jeremy Stavenhagen, Jeremy invented this device. So that what happened was that if we sat down with an artist, they would look towards the camera, but there was an angled half mirror. And in the half mirror, they'd see me sitting on an angle over here. And so they would talk to me, but the camera was filming through the half mirror. Wow. So when we, and then we also had another obvious principle, everybody spoke in their first language. Mm. So the interview with Joseph Beuys, one of the relatively late, the interview with Jean-Michel Basquiat, sadly, the last interview before he dies. We didn't know people were going to go. But equally, with Michael Nelson Chakamara, you know, with Michael speaking in his language, which we then, you know, got translated and subtitled. But it meant that we could have this sense of direct speech. Mm. And also that the kind of the eye distance was right, because in a sense, because of the looking through the mirror, it meant there was a focal point that's catching the focal point of the viewer. So it produces this intensity. But this was very deliberate.
Mm, yeah, it's really, really effective. So in that last episode, I think that really shows, again, this breadth that I think typifies your approach to things throughout your career. Like how did you develop, for want of a better expression, because we talked about networks before, but how did you develop that network? And that sense of, because now at the moment, all those people in the moment where you come to the UK, and you're looking at sort of black artists or kind of a black arts movement, I suppose, and Lebaina Hibbert, Sutapa Biswas. I think Sutapa's in it.
Should have appears briefly. Yeah, she was there, and Lebaina was part of that section.
Like, and it's almost like you're sort of appearing, there's a workshop happening, and people just, or they're installing something, they take some time out.
They're at the Roundhouse, they're doing a big project at the Roundhouse.
So, you know, and then you have that, but then you also have the Sydney Biennial, which is like up there, you know, it's a kind of top level thing, and you know, you have to travel halfway around the world. So how did you travel? I'm using these terms that are quite charged, and I don't mean them in the charged sense, but between these sort of high and low grounds, how?
Well, it interested me a lot about how art worlds work. I mean, I suppose I've begun always to be interested in thinking, how does change happen, and how does art happen? How does different kinds of art get seen by different people? Who controls things? That had always interested me. So I knew that when we did State of the Art, we had to have, if you like, that in it of talking about control and power. And it's in one of the earlier programs that we had the most difficult thing of filming with, you know, Mary Boone as a really high-powered dealer. She tried to take me to court. She tried to sue me. Is it four times after that? Because she didn't happen to like what we did. But, you know, it was really worth taking on. So I'd been interested in that. And therefore, I think I was very interested in thinking, you know, things appear in really interesting ways in different places. If you only pay attention to the kind of top public level of big museums or biennales, you're not going to get the most interesting things, or not all of them anyway. I'd had the opportunity anyway to go to Australia. We did a joint show with the Serpentine of artists from Australia at the ICA. I'd had another opportunity to go to Canada and had, for the first time, organised the first show with Jeff Wall, who I'd met out in Canada, and other artists I thought were really interesting out there. But in both cases, actually, I was hugely taken by the interest and complexity of what was happening for Indigenous artists and the positioning. The most particular thing that I found very difficult to understand from, if you like, from here in Britain, until one was there, was about land rights. Was saying, you know, you're not really going to understand the art politics if you don't get anywhere near understanding the actual politics of control of land and culture. Mm. And once, I suppose, it sounds a bit naive saying it, but once I got to that point of realising why that mattered so much, as it does, it seemed to me that what was happening in Australia and what was happening in Canada happened to be really good ways of thinking about questions of race and identity, which might be in this country more blurred, more complex in their own way. Mm. But if you like, TV-wise, and certainly again, we didn't go to Canada for State of the Art, we just went to Australia. And interesting, Channel 4 wouldn't pay for it. We actually had to raise the money ourselves. We were stretching the budget. And by that point, you know, for Jeff and John as collaborators in State of the Art, they realised why it mattered so much that we should go back to Australia and do that filming.
So there's a moment in that the beginning of the programme where there seems to be some sort of a performance by Aboriginal performers. I don't know if you'd even term it that way, in a gallery, but surrounded by what looked like sort of Australians of European descent.
Yes.
Which was really like kind of an uncomfortable viewing experience for me. What was it like for you to be there in that space?
It was both things at once. Yeah. In the sense it was uncomfortable because you thought, ooh, what's this sort of fetishized kind of performance, a bit of Aboriginal culture being brought in the gallery, But at the same time, actually it was very powerful. Mm. At the same time, these were Aboriginal artists who had chosen, there was no pressure, they had decided to use this as an occasion to show something of their culture. And of course, you know, one of the fascinating elements about the huge range of cultural cultures in the plural. I mean, you know, there were, we're reckoning 250 different Aboriginal languages. I mean, Michael Nelson Chakamara, who we worked with, Michael spoke five different languages, and at least two of those languages were as different as Russian and English. I mean, you know, really complex language background. So, and this is a culture that doesn't use writing, but uses signs and symbols and performance and many other, if you like, ritualistic elements. But a culture so different from ours, and these cultures so different. Anyway, what one felt one was getting was still something very powerful. Mm. But Aboriginal culture and its artifacts didn't really become, from all the evidence, didn't become much by way of artifact until contact. In other words, those Aboriginal peoples, for better or worse, decided to produce objects, things, at the point in which there was contact to other cultures arriving in Australia. And this felt like this was another aspect of a production of that moment. But it doesn't mean to say it wasn't, you're quite right, doesn't mean to say it wasn't awkward. Mm. But then I think you often think, working through awkwardness, difficulty, is part of what can also allow change. It depends who's controlling it.
I mean, yeah, because the audience themselves look kind of uncomfortable. Like, they're not quite sure what's going on or what role they are fulfilling as spectators.
Yeah, and we wanted to put that in the film. We wanted to make you, as a viewer of the film, think, well, where do I stand? What am I doing sitting watching this film, maybe the other side of the world? And what am I seeing from this moment? And what do I understand? How much am I being told? Well, you're not being told everything. You're being told probably, we hoped, as much to give an indication of it.
So the 1980s, from like my perspective now, seems to be a point at which the art world was, people acting in the art world were looking away from like the West to what might be termed the third world, and trying to bring that into the picture. And I'm glad you mentioned that you said, how does change happen? And I wanted to ask you, how does change happen? And was that in your mind when you moved from the ICA, finished your freelance stint and making this program, and then moving to Arts Council as Director of Visual Arts? Was that in your mind?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I say this with some reluctance because I wasn't kind of looking to go and do Arts Council. And the state of the art and being freelance had been terrific in the 80s. But of course, what was happening was that the politics were really tightening up, because we're getting into Thatcher period, in which there was really beginning to be new kinds of conflict and difficulties for artists in the arts world. And actually, it was a bunch of people, including Nick Soroto, who basically sort of ganged up on me and said, hey, look, Sandy, come on, you ought to apply. And you ought to apply to the Arts Council, particularly because Nick and I were amongst those who'd really argued with the Arts Council about them producing their own exhibitions, because they carried on in running the Hayward, the Serpentine, doing these touring shows, which they didn't do in theatre. I mean, the Arts Council never ran theatres, it never ran orchestras. And it was really getting very odd, this dislocation about why does the Arts Council run its own exhibitions and its own collection. Because it was like gamekeeper and poacher. Any of us who were trying to apply for grants felt we were always up against the Arts Council itself doing it. Anyway, eventually the Arts Council kind of got it, made the Hayward independent, that became part of South Bank, Serpentine became independent. Anyway, it was after that that I got ganged up on. And people said, well, you argued for this, now they've done it, you better go and apply to run the Arts Council. It was slightly to my surprise I got appointed. But when I arrived at the Arts Council, the thing I remember vividly was Joanna Drew, who was my predecessor, and Joanna, you know, wonderful woman, who then went over to the Hayward, continued as director in the South Bank setup. Joanna had left me her office in Piccadilly, where the Arts Council was then. And she'd left a top shelf just on the other side of the door. And as I came in to her office to take on the job, I realised she'd left a sequence of file boxes. And the file boxes had the names of artists on the file boxes, pretty much high up, pretty much over your head as you came in, I realised immediately what they were. They were each of the artists that had sued the Arts Council. They were all of them artists who'd had real battles. So, you know, I think it was Conrad Atkinson there, probably Rashid Areen was there. You know, each of them were there, and I thought, okay, this is good. This is hubris. This will help keep me in my place.
Yeah. So a lot of stuff started to happen and change into the 90s, out of those wrangles and the discourses and debates about centre into, sort of like margins into the centre, or at least attention from the centre given to the margins. One of which was the inauguration of Innova. Now, when I was talking to people, one of the things that prompted me to ask you for an interview is that I've been doing bits of research. I'm always doing research into, you know, British contemporary art, but your name kept coming up whenever something interesting was happening. And when I was talking about the history of Innova, people saying that you were quite key and involved in that. So could you maybe just tell me?
Well, it was, there was a really interesting moment of on one hand having to kind of defend the Arts Council against a government that frankly would have abolished it. I mean, I think Mrs. Thatcher and Les, other people much more senior than I was, were influential to try and say to her, actually this has a place. Because in a sense, she was a new kind of Toryism that wasn't the kind of old guard conservatives for whom, you know, going to the opera or going to probably ballet or stuff like that was kind of part of their life and culture. She wasn't part of that. She came from much more a middle class retail, Finchley background. And actually, so she didn't, in her own way, she wasn't in that kind of old style culture, and equally she wasn't part of anything kind of new populist at all. Anyway, so one end you were kind of fighting, and I thought that was really interesting about, you know, we had to kind of invent 3-year planning. We had to kind of get everybody doing marketing plans. We had to get everybody to kind of think, look, we can begin bringing in other monies. We can begin to get a kind of more open economics about this. So that was one side of it. And then the other side, of course, that interested me hugely, was how could artists have a better opportunity, and how could there be a greater diversity of artists that would have that opportunity? So one of the things I got very involved in was art for architecture and the Percent for Art movement, because actually, you know, we had a tiny amount of money, frankly, for subsidy. I mean, we had 4 million, and, you know, opera and music had huge amounts, had 40, 30 million or 40 million. I mean, these are still small sums against now. So I was thinking two things. One was, look, we need to push policy so that if we can get artists to get more work, i.e. working with architects and craftspeople too, that's great for everybody. We should be doing stuff like that. We should be campaigning and lobbying for the place that artists can have. But at the same time, we have to be attentive as to which artists. I mean, this isn't going to be any good if it's frankly just, you know, white guys who end up getting the work. So, of course, by this stage, you know, we were now many years on from the work that women artists and feminists have been doing, arguing for the place and recognition of women, but still having to argue. And we were some years already into the so-called Black Arts movement, of that incredibly, you know, that incredibly energetic young generation we mentioned, of Lubaina and Keith Piper and Donald Rodney and Sonia Boyce. But in a sense, they represented something much larger than just them. Yeah. And that was very clear. And it's why someone like Rashid Areen, you know, Rashid was really important, because he, and Gavin Yanchis was, you know, one of the other many influential figures, because they were, in a sense, they were very selfless. They were saying, look, this isn't about me. I mean, they might argue about themselves, but it was really saying, look, this is about how do we think about the mix of artists that we should be giving opportunities to. Anyway, so out of that, I was always looking for ways in which we could make change. And we did some sort of review work of thinking about it. And at one point, there was a very funny moment where we commissioned a report which got dubbed as Black Chapel. We said, well, can we make a kind of black version of White Chapel? And we used to call it Black Chapel, which was a kind of silly pun. But what actually happened was you may remember that the Roundhouse had been, anyway, it has its own complicated story, but at one point, the Roundhouse was kind of going to be a big black arts project and was going to be... It was going to be refashioned, but it all went pear-shaped. And for various reasons, the management didn't work out, the wrong people were involved, anyway, it didn't work through. Anyway, what was then happening was that the money that had been set aside for it was about to be carved up. And I spotted this, and it was about to all go off to the performing arts. So I absolutely thumbed my fist and said, no, we're getting a slice of that for visual arts. Mm. So that's where it started. So that slice became what became Innova. And what was great, of course, was that, you know, with fabulous and crucially important figures, inspirational figures like Stuart Hall, that someone like Stuart was prepared to help them get involved and guide. And then those who were directly running it. Also, of course, initially, we're not really thinking of having a place. Of course, you'll remember that Innova started
it
with
was
the
just
idea.
An agency.
Yeah, it was the idea there's an agency. But I think it was no surprise that pretty quickly everybody felt that you've got to try and have a place.
So in 1994, that's when Innova was sort of, was that his first year? And that was, that was the year of the New Internationalism Conference, I think, of which you were chair, which must have been exhausting. I've been watching some of those tapes, it goes on, and I mean, it's all really interesting, but...
Yeah, there was a lot of debate. But I mean, all I was trying to do from Arts Council was, and it had been, you know, we'd been doing very basic things like shifting who was on panels.
That's really important.
Inviting, well, it does, exactly. I mean, people sort of say, oh, is this kind of rote that you've got to kind of do? It's not rote. It makes a real difference. And, you know, there were moments when, certainly for the main art panel, for instance, we invited the lovely figure of Aubrey Williams, the painter. Aubrey, for a period, was on the visual arts panel. You know, he wouldn't say very much, but then we get right to the end of a discussion and Aubrey would quietly put up his hand and say something brilliant.
Yeah.
Totally brilliant. And you think, oh God, Aubrey, yeah, you completely got that. So I've been, you know, these kinds of things were pretty basic to try and get these shifts about what might be seemed as important, and also even tiny shifts of the allocation of resources. So yeah, it was those pretty obvious things.
But that was, so by this time you were back at Tate, so you'd finished...
Well, yeah, Arts Council drove me nuts after a bit. I mean, I did 5.5 years, and frankly, that was enough. I mean, it was a fact, you know, by this time, yeah, there were good moments. I mean, Peter Palumbo took over as chair, and Peter was, you know, it was quite a lot of debate. I mean, Peter was thinking about, oh, he just came and said, well, let's sell the Arts Council collection. And you're saying, hang on, let's just think. Anyway, so there's quite a lot of to and fro, and I learned lots about politics. That was great for me. I also learned much more about working across the country and about how to mix things across the country. So that was all good. But I couldn't carry on after a bit. I just thought I've got to do something else.
After you left the Tate, you then went as became director of National Portrait Gallery, and by all accounts really turned it around. And I'd say, I mean, what did you feel like you could bring? Because sometimes I feel about directorships, is your perception of doing the job, your desire to do the job, is it commensurate with the degree to which you feel you can change the institution or that your being there is going to have some impact on it? Was that how you felt, and what did you want to bring to them?
But you, I think for many, and certainly for me, you think about it as a team. Of course you think, what can I do? But you really think about, what can we do? The most interesting thing was that I just felt it could really step forward a whole nother step in terms of its programme, and I think I was aware of that. Also, I just thought there was this incredibly simple thing that this is a museum of people. You know, people think, oh, portraits, that's all a bit kind of old-fashioned and dusty Tudor portraits and boring, but actually I thought, no, hang on, just think of it the other way around. It's just a museum of people. But let's think who the people are. Let's think about whose stories, and let's think about how we can look at those in new ways. So in a sense, it was very simple. It then needed quite a lot of animation and teamwork to get it work. And of course, what happens now? You know, I support what colleagues continue to do and what my successor Nick Cullen is doing. So one tries to play one's part.
So looking back over, like I say, the 5 decades and counting, time that you're spending working with the arts, what has art given you, do you think?
Oh, just kind of everything. I mean, it's everything that sits alongside life. In other words, I don't count working with artists as in some separate space from having a family and having kids who've grown up and having my own parents and siblings and you know, those affections and love that really matters closely to one. So it sits in, if you like, in a frame that's alongside the rest of life. I don't see it as some separate thing, but I just feel I've been so lucky to work with some completely fascinating artists, many of whom I feel I'm still go back to and grapple with. Do I understand well enough what Joseph Beuys was really talking about. I don't know that I understand that well enough. When I see some of the amazing young artists coming up now and I think, oh God, I don't know enough about what they're doing. And I suppose I remain passionate about that sort of forms of inquiry and trying to understand a bit more. And of course about different kinds of sharing, and you know, some of what I'm up to now with the National Trust, St Paul's Cathedral, is about sharing in different places. Thank you.